Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the 9th episode of Radio Grimbald. On today's show, I'll be reading the 4th story in the Adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps series, Snakes and Ladders. For those of you joining this party already in progress, for the past 3 episodes, I've been reading from a series of short stories about the adventures of, you guessed it, Bo Ragnar Phelps. Although they stand on their own fairly well, I do recommend you head over to the episode index on the website, Radio Grimbald, and listen to them in order. Like I said before, this is the 4th in a series that, to this date, has over 10 installments. Also, as always, I should point out that this story, like virtually all of my stories, is set in a completely fictitious universe. So any deviancies you may notice in the names, religions, accents, or mythologies described herein can be attributed to that fact. I have been informed by the internets that today, the day you are receiving this podcast, is Valentine's Day. But since when I hear the name Valentine, I think of the character from the movie Mirror Mask rather than the gluttonously over-merchandised holiday, all I have to say in honor of the occasion is this. I don't care that I'm single. I'm a very important man, and I've got a tower. And look at you! You've got an entire episode of me reading you a story. So go cuddle up with a nice cup of tea, and maybe a cat, if you've got one. And enjoy. Snakes and Ladders. Copyright 2012. By Goldine Ogawa. In all my adventures with my friend, the remarkable magician Bo Ragnar Phelps, there have been precious few for which I was the catalyst. Usually his adventures arrived in the form of strange persons or unexplained notes, or he went and rooted them out himself. The following narrative, then, is an exception, and I hope my readers will forgive me if I begin with my own experiences, as these were what eventually necessitated the intervention of Bo Ragnar Phelps himself. It was in the fall of 2282 I had been living under his care for a year and a half when he finally capitulated to my never-ending pleas and arranged my enrolment in a respectable boarding school. The state of my education had gone dreadfully awry since I had come to live with him, as he would accept no governess of mine for more than a few weeks before dismissing her for one trivial reason or another. I raised an outcry at such treatment, and demanded that if he would not allow my education to come to me, I would go to my education. I engaged in many fierce and unladylike rows over this subject, all through the end of spring and in and out of summer. At the last, however, he relented, but only on the grounds that it would be for one term, and after Yuletide we would try again to arrange a tutor that was to both our likings. I will not bore you with the details of shopping, packing, and preparing that dominated my diary of the time. Suffice to say that, upon rereading it, I am horrified to find the pages filled with useless trivia that cast my 15-year-old self in a most unfavourable light. For this narrative, I have been obliged to make use of Phelps's notes, which tell me that on 15 September I was packed off to Holdswell House near Brussex in such a great display of high spirits that there is no hope of them lasting the journey, let alone the first week. In this prediction, Mr. Bo Ragnar Phelps was wrong, for my memory tells me that I thoroughly enjoyed my first week at Holdswell House, and was reasonably cheerful during the next. Only in the third did my spirits drop, but here I am getting ahead of myself. Let us go back a while, and I will try to describe the stage upon which the following drama will be enacted. Holdswell House was, in those days, an old-fashioned boarding school for old-fashioned upright girls. It stood on the outskirts of Brussels, in the Gold Rush Delta by the sea, surrounded by interlacing roads and marshes, which sometimes combined with unfavourable results. Although it was a bleak and dreary scene in the fall, only a few miles to the west there was the glory of the Golden Bay coast, from which direction one could always hear the distant cry of gulls and feel the gentle presence of the westerly sea wind. The house itself was several buildings, all of red brick in varying degrees of decay. There was a quadrangle with a severe green lawn and hard stone benches, in the centre of which was a statue on top of a fountain that never ran. All in all, it was a sombre, earthy, open sort of place, and as someone recently come from the stifling confines of Redling, I enjoyed it immensely. I was set up in the north dormitory, along with 20 or so other girls, although we ate and had classes in the main house, along with the girls of the south and east dorms. All that was left of the west dormitory was a weather-beaten brick skeleton of a building, with no roof and half its walls missing. According to our astronomy teacher, Miss Killam, it had fallen into disrepair when the school was short of money, and no one had bothered to rebuild it. This was a delight to the older girls, who used some of the upstairs rooms as a cache for hidden treasures. There was also the basement, which was a labyrinth of junk, loose brick, mortar, and rubble. Cobwebs hung in curtains from the ceiling, and it smelled of dead secrets and fear. The fear was understandable, for it was the abominable habit of the older girls to force new students to spend at least one night in that place during their first month, with nothing but a candle and a thin spare blanket. If the teachers knew of this ordeal, they did nothing to stop it, and no one talked about it except in hushed whispers just before bedtime. I didn't find out about it until the beginning of my third week, when Brunda Geist and Charity Hilda, both 3 years older than myself, taller and heavier, intercepted me as I was heading back to the north dorm across the quadrangle.
"We'd like a minute with you, Birch,"
Hilda said, grabbing me by the elbow before I could get away.
"You've been here for quite some time now, haven't you?"
Geist remarked. I nodded curtly, wanting to escape as quickly as I could, for they were not pleasant company at the best of times.
"But we get the impression you're not really one of the lasses yet,"
Hilda added gravely. "Oh, what are you talking about?" I asked, trying vainly to twist my arm free. I glanced about, looking for the aid of a teacher, but the quadrangle was deserted, no doubt by Geist and Hilda's design.
"Birch is feeling a mite left out, isn't she?"
Geist said, ignoring my efforts to escape.
"Aye, I fancy so. But I know a way that we can make you feel just like us. Come on!"
And so saying, Geist took my other elbow and propelled me across the quad, past the western wing of the house, and out to what was left of the west dorm. When I saw its forbidding shape on the horizon, I considered digging in my heels and screaming as hard as I could, but now I found that the pride I had acquired while living with Phelps prevented me from taking the coward's way out. I had seen firsthand the derailing of a centuries-old curse, the remains of a girl who had become a tree, and even come face to face with a vampire. I could handle whatever those girls had in store. What they had in store turned out to be a bit of a letdown, at least by Phelps's standards. They gave me an old blanket that smelled faintly vile, a small box of matches, and a stump of a candle, just enough to see by, but not enough to burn all night. I was then pushed, none too gently, down a rickety flight of steps and through a barred door. There followed a slight drop, which I did not see due to the lack of light, and I tripped, dropping my matches in the process. There was some cruel laughter from above and behind me, and a scraping as the door was dragged shut. Frantically, I scrambled about for my matches before I lost what little light I had, but they had skidded off somewhere, and I ended up shut in the dark with an unlit candle and no means to light it. Resigning myself to a cold, dark night, I wrapped the pathetic blanket around my shoulders and tried to find the softest bit of floor to curl up on. At first I was quite certain sleep would evade me, but I must have dozed off at some point, because I remember being woken up by a faint whimpering sound. Opening my eyes, I saw with surprise that the place was not pitch black as I had first thought. There was a dim yellowish glow that, although it could not be called a light, was just enough to cast the large cloth-covered piece of furniture in front of me as a great black shadow. As the sleep cleared from my head, I noticed the glow flicker, like a candle would. Then there came the whimpering sound again, and it was unmistakable. There was another poor girl locked in the basement with me. I picked up my candle stump, useless though it was, and crawled on hands and knees towards the glow. It was rough going. I had to scramble over many foul-smelling mattresses and got cobwebs all over my hair. When I arrived, I saw the light was indeed a candle, even shorter than my own, that was flickering in the twitching grasp of a white-faced girl perhaps a year younger than myself. Although her eyes were squeezed tight, I could tell she had been crying, and even now she let out occasional whimpers.
Hello?
I called gently, inching into the light. The girl's immediate reaction was to scream and drop her candle, which went out, and then scream again. What followed was a confused and somewhat painful time as we each exclaimed at one another, found that we were not a threat, subsequently apologized, and then stepped on each other's hands trying to find the dropped candle. Eventually the girl had the sense to strike a match, and we lit mine. But even with its help, we could not find her candle. When we were finally settled, with the meagre stump of a candle flickering between us, I dared strike up a conversation.
"Alice Wintrow, Eastdorm," the girl said upon inquiry. "Acorian Birch, Northdorm," I replied, and together we wondered at the luck of us being put down in the basement on the same night. "Indeed, I don't know if I would have been able to manage alone," Alice admitted. She certainly looked close to the end of her tether, although it was hard to judge in the poor light. "I have always had an irrational fear of dark places," she added. I nodded understandingly, and after a few more minutes of quiet talk, we decided to settle down. Because she looked so strained, I offered that we should rest back to back. That way we would not worry about anything creeping up behind us, if there were anything down there at all. It ended up being more difficult for me, as Alice insisted on holding what was left of the candle, and I was left with our distorted, jerking shadows stretched out before me. To cheer us both up and to help drive away the creeping fear that clung to the place, I told her stories of my guardian, Boegner Phelps, his eccentricities, habits, and purple clothes. Eventually, our conversation died down, and we were left to pass the remainder of the night in weary silence. Because there were no windows, it was impossible to tell when dawn was coming, and when the older girls threw open the doors, letting in a stream of early morning light, I was almost blinded. Along with the light came the angrily raised voice of Geist, and a shrill northern voice I did not recognize. They were arguing passionately about something, but by the time Alice and I had emerged, blinking from the inky basement, they had settled the dispute. The shrill northern voice turned out to belong to a wiry girl from the East Storm who marched Alice away at once. Geist gave me an annoyed look and shoved me out the door. After that trying incident, life returned more or less to normal, although on my first night back in the dorm, the other new students had to gather around my bed and clamour for the tale. They seemed vastly disappointed when I told them it was more boring than scary, and a few of the older girls scoffed and said that I was putting on an act, saying I hadn't been frightened. "Well, the dark was a little frightening at first," I amended, trying to keep the peace. "And I had lost my matches, so I couldn't make a light."
There were shocked gasps all around.
"No light?"
asked a wide-eyed first year.
"How did you keep away the shadow tentacles?"
"Shadow tentacles?" I repeated, mystified. Looks of consternation were exchanged.
"But surely you heard his chains clinking."
"Whose chains?"
"She didn't hear the chains. She didn't now. What about the moaning?"
I shrugged. The only moaning I heard came from Wintrow, and that was more of a sobbing.
"Hold a moment,"
a chubby third year said.
You weren't down there alone?
Well, no, I admitted. There was another girl, from the East Dorm.
Fancy that! Not much of an ordeal when you've got company, I guess. Lucky blighter.
I lay alone and confused that night. What was supposed to have happened in the basement that had not? And why was I considered lucky? My last question would be answered within the week when, on Wednesday night, we were all woken around an hour before midnight by the most terrible screaming. It echoed through the dorms and around the grounds and seemed to be coming from everywhere at once. I was terribly puzzled by it, but the rest gave each other knowing looks and pulled their pillows over their ears. The next morning, I happened to meet Alice Wintrow in the quadrangle, and I was shocked to find her green and wobbly and only half-conscious. She had terrible bags under her eyes, which were wide and staring, and the look of a hunted mouse. She wouldn't speak to me, and was hurried away by the wiry northern girl from East Dorm, whom I had seen before. One of the passing fourth years from the East Dorm saw me staring after the two and explained that Wintrow had been made to spend another night in the basement, since her one with me didn't count. From this, I deduced that the same treatment would most likely be meted out to me by either Geist or Hilda, and from then on I took great care to avoid them. And I had good reason. Alice Wintrow's condition steadily deteriorated, until by the end of the week she was bedridden in the infirmary. All the teachers were under the impression that she was afflicted by the flu, but the girls knew better, and her plight cast a shadow over the spirit in the dorms. I continued to avoid the older girls, almost too easily, until I realized they were avoiding me as well. This puzzled me greatly, but over the next week I decided there could be no doubt. They never looked at me in class, and were always away or unavailable in the evenings. I took this as providence at first, and even dared to hope I would not have to sit through another night in the basement. For some reason it frightened me more and more, and as Alice remained in the infirmary, delirious now, it grew into a sort of black, mortal dread. Then on Friday, almost 2 weeks after that first fateful night, I was plucked out of class by the school nurse and dragged to the infirmary. The nurse was almost as unsteady as Alice had been, and twisted her apron nervously as she spoke. "I really don't know what to do about this, Miss Birch, and I'm sure I do apologise, but she has been most insistent these past few days. I hate to think it's contagious, but myself and Borrowed have been tending her all week with no ill effects, so I don't think you need worry. Still, best you have a good look and wash after, and don't get too close. She was quite violent yesterday." "I beg pardon?" I said, terribly confused. The nurse looked lost, then blushed and folded her apron into knots.
"I'm so terribly sorry, Miss Birch. I should have told you straight off. It's the girl from East Dorm, Alice Wintrow. She's in a terrible state and has demanded to see you."
When I entered the sparsely furnished infirmary ward, the first thing I saw was Alice, pale and red-eyed, stretched out on a bed. Her eyes were wide open and darting this way and that, and I could see her hands twitching beneath the sheets. The nurse shut the door behind me with a sharp snap, and we were alone.
"Alice," I said, approaching the bed with care. "It's me. It's Corianne."
But she didn't seem to notice me, staring about the room as if she were trying to see all of it at once. Only when I had come within a few feet of the bed did she react, darting out a hand and grabbing me by my wrist. I held perfectly still.
"Corianne! Make him go away, Corianne!"
she said hoarsely.
"He won't stop staring at me!"
I looked around the room. We were completely alone.
"There's no one else here, Alice," I said. "Who are you talking about?"
The poor girl gasped and gripped my arm so I thought it would fall off. Even her lips had gone white now.
"The snake on the ladder,"
she gasped, and fainted away. It took me some time to extricate my arm from her hand, and by the time I had, the nurse had put her head fearfully around the door.
"Is she better, Miss Birch?" the woman asked.
"She has fainted," I said, rubbing my arm gingerly.
"Oh, dear."
The nurse was twisting her apron again.
"I had hoped you would be able to bring her round. She kept on saying, in her delirium, that you had made it go away before. I thought maybe..."
But whatever she thought, I didn't hear, for my mind had jumped back to that night in the basement. The two of us, sitting back to back, and me staring out at the dancing shadows. What had I made go away? There hadn't been anything then. Had there? Quite suddenly I found myself shaking. Not with fear, but anger. Anger at the overbearing, bullying girls who had forced us down in that basement simply to meet their own demented standards. And here was Alice, suffering for it. I owed it to her as much as to myself to find out just what was down there. I strode out of the infirmary, leaving the nurse speechless, with a mind to do just that. I would throw open all the doors and windows and let all the terrible brightness of the day down in to burn whatever lurked there. I got halfway across the quad and realized this was impossible. No student was allowed near the West Dorm, not when you could be spotted and given detention, and I was late for class. Stamping my foot in irritation, I was forced to leave my quest unfinished for the moment, resolving to come back as soon as I was free, when there was still some afternoon light. But that afternoon there was always at least one teacher present when I went to sneak into the dorm, and I realized the only time one could get in at all was at night. That gave me pause, but then I had another idea. An idea so perfect it warmed my fear-chilled body to the bone. Geist and Hilda were sitting loftily apart from the other students in the common room, and as soon as they saw me enter, they made to disappear. I had had enough of their game by then, however, and dove across the room to catch Hilda by the tail end of her skirt. She looked down at me with haughty fury, as if I had gone mad.
"I must talk with you," I said grimly, "about the basement in the West Dorm and Alice Wintrow."
The two exchanged resigned looks.
"Up here, then," Geist said.
They led me up the stairs to the senior girls' room, an honour that was utterly lost on me, and sat down. I remained standing. I was taller than them like that.
"The basement in the West Dorm," I began, but Hilda cut me off. "It's not our fault if that's what you're thinking," she cried. "We never put nothing down there."
So they at least believed something was in the basement. I felt a shiver that might have been fear and might have been excitement run down my spine.
"Do you have any idea what it is?" I asked, skipping what I had been about to say.
Geist looked closed and knitted her eyebrows. Hilda was flabbergasted.
"Whatever it was, it hurt Wintrow," I continued, hammering my point home. "Did you know she's delirious? And she kept asking the nurses for me. She seemed to think I could save her."
"We don't know. Nothing like this has happened before."
"Lie," went through my head faster than I could think.
It was written all over their secretive, guilty faces. I played my last card.
"If you two don't know, then I'm going down into that basement again, as I ought to have last week by your reasoning, and I'll find out what's down there."
The reaction this provoked was remarkable. Geist surged to her feet and Hilda gasped at me in disbelief.
"You're mad," Geist said.
"Someone must do it," I said.
"We must do something, or the head may actually take notice."
The thought of their pranks being addressed by the staff was enough to sober them.
"Whatever you say, I'm going down there tonight."
Obvious looks of relief flooded their faces as I said this, which lasted only moments before I added, maliciously,
"And I think you should come as well. Six eyes can see more than two."
The difference between my company on my first trip to the basement and my second was startling. Instead of being lofty and forbidding, Geist and Hilda now carried themselves with barely concealed terror. Even though I had brought enough candles to last the whole night, they insisted on taking one each and staying by the foot of the stairs, huddled together like a pair of neurotic owls. Lighting a candle of my own and stowing the rest in my pocket, I picked my way through the rubbish to about where I had found Alice on my first night.
It was a long, weary vigil, at least at first. Several times I would have nodded off were it not for the frequent stifled squeals and nervous chatter of my cowering companions. Then, when my head was hoping it was almost dawn, but I knew deep down it was only midnight, I heard something that was neither a stifled squeal nor one of Hilda's ill-fated attempts at conversation. A gentle, sighing breath passed through the air. It brought with it a smell of deep caverns and wet caves, and soon after a soft sound like a velvet cape flapping in the wind. Hilda screamed. Geist hollered. I nearly put my candle out as I came running and scrambling. They were cowered against the wall beside the stairs, which they had apparently forgotten in their terror. And such terror! They were both beyond white, almost greenish, and Hilda's eyes looked ready to pop out of her head. I turned the same direction they were looking, bringing my hand up to shade the glare from my candle. What I saw was hard to see, and even harder to describe. I got the impression of a shadow in the darkness that turned aside the light from our candles. It was difficult to make out, except that it was long and thin and weaved about like a snake. It was slowly advancing on us in tentative, wispy motions. The wonder of it all was that I did not scream, for I was certainly terrified enough. I can thank Geist and Hilda for that. Their screaming sufficed for all of us. Instead, I batted at the shadow with my free hand and shouted at it as though it were a dog chasing me down the street. "Go! Go!" I shouted. "Go away! Go!" And it went. It flicked out of sight like the darkness does when one turns on a light. My candle flared slightly, as if it had been damped by the thing's presence, and suddenly the basement was brilliantly lit by our three flames. Geist and Hilda screamed louder than ever. After that, the night passed in relative calm, though Geist and Hilda were grey and shaking. None of us were in the best of moods the next morning, and I was secretly hoping I could nap away my afternoon classes, but just as I was finishing luncheon, the nurse turned up again. Miss Wintrow was worse today, and could I be bothered to come along? Alice was a pale, shaking wisp of the girl I had met a fortnight ago. I was shocked and a little frightened at her deterioration, and although I sat with her, dozing despite myself, for the better part of the afternoon, she showed no improvement. The nurse was nearly in tears, having tried every cure the school's resources could provide, and wrung her hands as she detailed to me all the complication involved in having a specialist out from Redling. At this rather extreme notion, I asked whether the girl's parents had been contacted, and was informed they were out of the country. I went to bed very troubled, and kept going over the events of the past day and night in my head. I was dreadfully tired and longed to get to sleep, but I stayed awake long into the night, until something the nurse said echoed back into my mind. A specialist from Redling. I knew a specialist in Redling. I knew a very special specialist. I made up my mind, there and then, to write to Phelps and tell him everything. I did so the next morning, the moment I got out of bed. I felt ashamed and a little guilty as I took up my pen and paper to explain the events of the past weeks. For once I had it down, everything seemed trivial and unimportant. Had I known Phelps as well then as I do now, I would probably not have felt this way. The reply to my letter came the next day in the form of Beau Ragnar Phelps himself. He turned up in the middle of morning class, tall and lean and trim and purple-coated as ever, with his favourite walking cane in the crook of his arm and hat in hand. He was accompanied, much to my chagrin, by the head, a grim grey lady whom I had had the fortune so far not to cross. Our teacher ignored their entrance and continued droning on with the morning lesson until Phelps cocked his head at the head, who coughed loudly. Our teacher, Miss Ipsworth, started as if someone had struck her. She stared first at the head and then at Phelps with an expression of vague bewilderment. "Miss Birch," the head said in tones to make a dragon freeze,
Come with us, please.
Mutely, I stood up, feeling foolish and embarrassed. Of course I should have gone straight to the head instead of sending off the letter to Phelps. What had I been thinking? But how was I to know he would come the very next day? I was so busy berating myself that I nearly missed the sly wink he shot my way as we turned to follow the head down to her office. At first I couldn't imagine what he intended by it until we were halfway down the hall and the head was marching on in front of us. Here he loitered and lingered from one long leg to the other, letting the head get further and further away. At length she turned down another hall, and Phelps heaved a sigh of relief and turned to me.
"Either the food here is very poor, or your adventures have been worse than you implied,"
said he, taking me by the arm.
"I hope you're well enough to talk of them, however, as from your letter I perceive the medium prevented you from describing the situation adequately."
"Yes, yes," I said. "But the head—"
"We'll spend the rest of the day believing I have already left. Now please, dear Corianne, do tell. And then we must see this sick friend of yours."
It was a great relief to speak freely of my escapades, and as we walked in circles through the halls I poured out all my experiences of the past 2 weeks. Phelps listened with commendable patience, and at the time I thought I must have seemed quite unsteady for him to show this kind of care with me. It never occurred to me that he was just glad to see me again. When at last I had finished, and we were on our third circuit of the south corridors, Phelps took us out through the postern door and onto the small lawn outside. From here we could see most of the buildings, even the old west dorm poking a bit of roof out from behind the mess hall.
"Now, let me see if I have my bearings," Phelps said, letting go of my arm for the first time in half an hour. "There is your dormitory, behind the spire. Good. And here we have the main building and its side wings and the mess hall, and beyond that, this troublesome west dorm. Quite a ways, is it not?"
He gave me an inquisitive look. I hung my head and tried not to meet his eyes, for in my letter and all my babbling earlier I had neglected to mention Geist and Hilda's role in all this. It felt wrong, somehow, despite all they had done, to tattle on them.
"Yes, I suppose it is," I mumbled.
"Why ever did you go so far to get to a place like that?"
It was only a bit of fun."
"Ah, Corianne,"
Phelps said gently, patting my shoulder.
"That was a lie."
It wasn't spoken as a rebuke, but I felt my face flush with shame. Phelps put his hands in his pockets and smiled pleasantly.
"I would not ask, unless it were important," said he. "But what in the world possessed you to go into a place like that? It positively reeks."
"Reeks?"
"Of fear. I sense a great deal of fear, whether it is from it or of it. That place is filled with the most potent kind of dread."
I twisted my hands nervously, teetering on the brink of the precipice I had been treading. With a sigh, I let go and told Phelps everything about Geist and Hilda and the test first years were made to go through. He listened, his expression growing ever grimmer, until I had finished.
"I see,"
was all he would say, and bade me lead him to the infirmary. The nurses were a little less shocked than I expected at seeing him, and once I had explained the situation in full, they ushered us into Alice's room quite gladly. The poor girl was a mere wraith, pale and delirious and staring with unfocused eyes at some part of the ceiling. Phelps knelt by the bedside, taking her hand in his and putting his other over her forehead. For some minutes they sat in stillness, until all at once Alice relaxed visibly and lay back against her pillow with a soft sigh, fast asleep. Phelps stood up, his face anything but relaxed, and smoothed back his hair in a way I had come to recognize as agitation.
"Sir, will she be all right?" the nurse asked anxiously.
"At this moment, I fear her condition is not yet resolved," he replied, straightening his collar.
"But what happened?" I pressed.
"This girl," has been exposed to a whoremonger, dear Corian. Now come, I think it is time we paid another visit to the headmistress.
But what is a whoremonger? I asked as I trotted desperately to keep up with Phelps's long strides as we hurried down the hall to the head's office.
A kind of shadow creature, he explained distractedly. They don't harm people, intentionally, that is, but they can have a most unfortunate effect if one meets them unawares. Usually this only applies to children, but our poor Miss Wintrow most certainly saw it, and... His voice dropped softly. So did you. I thought of the shadow that looked like a snake, and shivered. The head looked sharply up as we entered her office unannounced and stared at us in vague irritation.
Mr. Phelps, she said briskly, shuffling some papers aside, I was under the impression that you had left.
I'm afraid that is not the case, Phelps said, drawing up a chair and sitting down. He motioned me to do the same. For there are one or two matters on which I desire clarification, for curiosity's sake. The head sighed expressively, put her pen away and clasped her hands before her, looking put upon. First of all, I feel obliged to say that I am certain that the treatment my ward receives here is nothing less than stellar. But I am also curious as to the history of these buildings. I am rather keen on architecture, you see.
History? The head looked politely blank.
When were they built? Who was the architect? Any interesting peculiarities? Phelps trailed off suggestively.
Mr. Phelps, the head said severely, you can hardly expect me to entertain your curiosity about such things, but there is plenty of material in the library should you wish to pursue your inquiries.
Phelps leaned back in his chair and sighed. Then, to my surprise, he stood up, beckoning to me, and walked to the door.
I have just one last question, madame, a small one, he said. What is that?
Would you be so kind as to remind me when the school was founded? And who founded it?
It was established in 2197 by Erisia Tor.
Thank you, madam, Phelps said placidly, and ushered me out into the hall. Once there he turned to me, clasping his hands in front of him. Dear Corian, said he, I believe I have taken up altogether too much of your valuable schooling time. Now, why don't you run back to class? They must still be having classes, mustn't they? And I shall amuse myself in the library. We shall meet again at 8 this evening, outside the West Dormitory. Wear something warm, and don't bother to bring a light. So saying, he gave me a curt nod and strode off down the hall, purple coat-tails billowing behind him. I was left, confused and excited, to wander off to catch the final minutes of my last class for the day. I do not remember any of it. The night was cold and blustering, and the wind promised a storm rolling in from the ocean. I had no trouble obeying Phelps's first order, bundled up in all my warmest petticoats, cloaks and shawls as I was, but I couldn't resist bringing a single candle, just in case. But there was no point in lighting it outside in the gusting wind, so I waited in darkness by the west dorm for some minutes as my eyes became accustomed to the night. Phelps emerged from that darkness so smoothly and silently I jumped when I finally noticed him. He was pale against the shadowy ground in his favourite lavender overcoat, which looked more greyish now. In his left hand he carried his cane, and by his right, I started as I saw part of the shadow next to him move. It walked like a heavy sheepdog, with plodding, deliberate steps, only its movement was also somehow fluid. It was about the size of a large dog, and the only way I could tell it apart from the rest of the night was by the fact that it was utterly and completely black. Good evening, Corian, Phelps said pleasantly. He glanced at my shocked expression and then down at the shadow at his waist. Oh, he said. "Have you not met Una, then?" I shook my head. Although I had heard of her before, the reason my readers have not is simply because she had never yet played an interesting role in my adventures. Now she gazed up at me with eyes that were felt more than seen, and a part of her shadowiness wagged like a tail.
"Pleased to meet you, Una," I said, extending my hand apprehensively.
A part of the darkness reached out and touched it, tingling on my skin in not an unpleasant way. "I believe Una will be of great help tonight," Phelps said, pushing the door of the dorm open. "She is very good at smelling out Hormanders, being one herself." With this comforting knowledge, I followed Phelps inside, across the derelict hall and down the stairs. He walked in front, assuredly, and never asked for directions. He simply followed wherever Una went. He unlatched the door of the basement and did not even exclaim as he met the steep step there. The basement was black as pitch, and I was sorely tempted to light my candle, but I resisted. Phelps took my hand and led me gently along a path only he could see, through the haphazard debris and junk, across the room, right to the back wall. Here he bent over and felt the floor, then paused for a brief, silent conversation with Una, before standing back up again.
"There's a trap door. We must go down," he said softly in my ear. "Do not make a sound, and whatever you do, do not be afraid."
"Why ever not?" I asked, startled.
"Hormanders react badly to fear. They become violent."
"Violent?" I repeated, alarmed, but Phelps was already scraping about on the floor, getting the trap door open. Apparently it was stiff, and some of the hinges were rusted over. I wondered, while I waited, where Una had gone, or if she was standing right next to me. There was no way to distinguish her from the surrounding darkness. At long last, Phelps was obligated to say a few spells to make the hinges work, which they grudgingly did, and I heard him lower himself through the hall, muttering, "After you, Una." I felt a flimsy ladder beneath my feet when I lowered them through the trap door. The way it swayed and jerked told me it was most likely rope, and when I felt it, I was struck by how thin and frayed it was. If I had not heard Phelps hastily muttering strengthening spells below me, I would have feared for our safety. As it was, I had a nerve-wracking climb down that ladder. I could see nothing around me, no light above nor below, and when I reached out my arm, felt nothing but empty air. All around, everything was darkness, with the only sound being the ominous creaking of the rope ladder. To take my mind off it all, I asked a question that had been pestering me for some time. "Phelps, what is a Hormander? I mean, what's a shadow creature?"
"A shadow creature," Phelps's voice replied from below me, "is something that exists on the edge of our dimension. Usually they feed off ambient emotions and are quite harmless."
"What do you mean by usually harmless?"
"When faced with an overabundance of one kind of emotion or another, they have an adverse reaction. Too much fear bloats them and makes them aggressive. Too much happiness and they become witless nincompoops."
There was a whine from Una that sounded definitely apologetic, and then silence. After an interminable descent, I became aware of a faint yellowish light growing beneath us. Light which solidified into a glowing gold bar illuminating the floor. I looked down just in time to see Phelps step off the ladder and resisted the temptation to look up at what we had descended. Una was a vague dog-like shadow crouched by Phelps's feet when I finally alighted, and Phelps himself was looking at the source of the light with moderate surprise. It was an open door, and beyond the door was a flimsy curtain. From beyond this, there was music playing. Things on the top of Una's head that might have been ears twitched appreciatively at the sound. Phelps strode boldly forward and swept aside the curtain, motioning me to follow. Beyond that was a short,
low stone corridor carved roughly out of the rock, through which I could see the source of the light. A bright, flickering lamp atop a stone post that grew out of the centre of the room. The music was louder here, but I still could not tell where it was coming from. There was a roughly carved door on the wall beyond the lamppost. Una trotted over to it at once and began snuffling eagerly at its base. Phelps, who had been examining a carving on the lamppost, left it and walked over to the door, which he carefully unlatched. Light and music streamed in, and as one we poked our heads around the door. I felt my eyes grow wide as they met the sight on the other side. It was a room richly furnished in the style of an elegant country lounge, with lamps burning on every wall, giving the whole place a bright, warm glow. There were many pieces of beautifully upholstered furniture and a magnificent green and gold rug upon the floor. The warbling music sounded like that of a flute, and it was coming from just behind one of the high-backed armchairs across the room. We approached the chair, and coming around, I was finally able to set my eyes on its occupant. It was a shadow, like Una, completely black and without feature and somewhat vague around the edges. Only this one was in the shape of a long, coiling snake. Several feet of tail were stretched across the floor, and the flute it was playing appeared to be floating in mid-air. Phelps cleared his throat politely, and the shadow snake jumped about 3 feet. "Goodness me!" it exclaimed in surprise, sending the flute clattering to the ground where it rolled under a table. "Whatever do you want?" Phelps bowed politely and took off his hat. He shot me a significant glance, and I hastily performed a curtsy. "Apologies for our intrusion. We only need a few minutes of your time," he said gently. "I am Beauregna Phelps. The name may be familiar to you. And this is my ward, Corianne Birch. And this is Una. I am investigating the disturbances in the West Dormitory of the past weeks, and there are one or two points I was hoping you could clarify for me." "Oh." The snake shadow swayed side to side indecisively, then seemed to relax.
"A fair request," it said.
It flicked a couple inches of its long, thin tail, and 3 well-cushioned armchairs waddled forward. After we had seated ourselves, the snake stretched itself out a little nervously, coiling and uncoiling its tail the whole time.
"I fear introductions are not my strong point," it said. "But you may call me Clarent. And these,"
he tapped his tail softly on the carpet,
"are my children."
For a moment it looked like a great swarming shadow had suddenly spread across the carpet, but it quickly dispersed into many small, writhing snakes. Despite Phelps's warning against fear, I felt a shudder run up my spine at the sight. Una made appreciative noises and leaned down to touch noses with each little snake. Phelps nodded graciously to them, a small smile tugging at his lips. One of the little snake shadows detached itself from the writhing mass and wriggled over to me, slumping at my feet in a puddle of darkness. A small voice, hissing and faint, whispered words I didn't catch.
"I beg your pardon,"
I said, forcing myself to lean forward and down.
"I apologize,"
the little shadow hissed, managing, if possible, to look even more glum.
"You have already met Piora here,"
Clarent coughed.
"I believe it was she who gave you and your friends such a fright the other night."
I looked down at the tiny, quivering shadow, trying to imagine it reared up and menacing. Then I realized that whatever it was, it had given me a polite apology, and I was merely staring at it in dumb amazement.
"That's quite all right," I said graciously. "No harm done."
To my consternation, the little shadow gave a delighted fizzle and jumped into my lap. But she didn't feel unpleasant and weighed no more than a frail silk scarf. I looked at Phelps, confused.
"Just what has been going on?"
I asked. Phelps smiled, leaning back in his chair and crossing his long legs.
I think Clarent is more fit to explain that, although I have, of course, formed my own theories. The truth will be far more satisfying.
The Hormander wriggled uncomfortably, then sighed and settled back against his cushions.
The truth is simple enough. For the past 8 decades, this has been my home. But before that, as a Hormander, I encountered all manner of problems trying to find a place to settle down. Every time I thought I had found a suitable home, someone would get wind of it and send a magician around to exorcise me. Then, 80 years ago, I had the good fortune to meet a most extraordinary woman by the name of Erisia Tor. It was she who built this school, and with it this place. My home. He gestured with his tail at the richly decorated room around us. As you can imagine, it was everything I'd ever hoped for, and for many years I'd lived in peace. I even started a family. My problems began 15 years ago, when the building above us was abandoned. Until then we were able to live comfortably off the mixed emotions that filtered down from those living above us, but once they were gone our lives became increasingly difficult. Still, we managed to get by until someone started forcing students down into the basement. That was when things went very wrong for us. We sense people more strongly the closer they are, so the fear that came down from the basement was potent and terrible. And whether because of our influence or theirs, the place began to stink of fear. More than once it has nearly driven me mad. I cannot imagine what idiocy kept the children coming down there, but they did, and as time passed, the roots of fear grew deep and threatened to crumble the very walls of my home. But then, during one of these most recent episodes, well, it is difficult to explain, but you must understand that when we are near someone who is mortally afraid, a terrible madness takes us. We are unable to control ourselves, and our power runs rampant. But on this night, when ordinarily all we ever felt was fear and insanity, there was a strange reprieve. Here the shadowy figure paused and flicked its tongue at me. Phelps raised an eyebrow, folding his long hands together, and waited patiently for our host to continue. So surprised was I that, after the better part of the night, I went up to investigate, and found it was merely 2 young girls sitting together on the floor, one of whom I now see before me. At the time, I could not contain my astonishment and went nearer to investigate. But before I could get close, I felt myself turned away by some magical barrier that blocked any attempt I made to breach it. Defeated, I nevertheless was able to return home and spend a peaceful night for once. I must assure you that I never meant any harm, and neither did Piora when she approached you a few nights ago. I can only assume this is what you are inquiring about, but if there is anything left for me to explain, I would happily do so.
Oh, but there is,
I began, my mind darting to Alice, delirious in the infirmary.
Not so much something to explain, Phelps cut in smoothly, no doubt sensing my agitation, but rather something that must be rectified. I believe we both have an interest in doing that. Sir Clarent, you have not told me all, for I know that one of your number, if the human it touched is anything to judge by, must be in a perilous state of health.
The darkness seemed to grow about Clarent, and he coiled in on himself as if wishing to disappear.
You speak truly,
he said, flicking his tail in agitation.
Not long after this first strange occurrence, one of the girls returned, but now she was just as frightened as usual. Against my wishes, one of my children snuck up to have a look, but he never came back. I was obliged to go and fetch him, and what I found...
The Hormander trailed off, looking down at his tail.
He's not well at all. I don't think there is anything that can be done for him.
Nevertheless, I would like to see him, Phelps said, rising from his chair.
I should warn you, he is in a most precarious state. Any disturbance...
I assure you, I will not do anything to disturb him. I merely wish to see. And if your son is indeed in such ill health, I fancy something must be done at once."
Clarent looked ready to argue further, but Una made a plaintive noise and growled faintly. The snake shot her a surprised glance, then seemed to shrug to himself and sighed.
"I suppose someone like you could do no further harm," said he, slithering out of his chair. "Very well. Follow me."
The hallmander led us to a side door, which swung open on its own, and down through a darkened corridor to a doorway hung with purple curtains. Phelps stepped through after our guide, holding them aside for me as I followed. Inside it was dark, lit only by a faintly glowing bracket attached to the ceiling, carved in the design of an ornate serpent. There were odds and ends scattered about the room, a broken chair here, a shoe there, and many other things I could not recognize due to the lack of light, except the one that I stepped on, which turned out to be a stuffed bear. In the center of the room there was a baby's cradle draped about with blankets, and from this a tangible darkness emerged, twisting in the air like heavy smoke. It smelled of something old and forgotten, rotting away in some dark corner. I drew back, not wanting to get any closer than I had to, but Phelps swept right up to the side of the cradle and peered keenly down into the darkness. I felt more than saw Clarent at my side, anxiously watching. After a moment, Phelps beckoned me over. I felt unstable, but managed to cross the distance between us and stand by his side. His steadying hand descended on my shoulder, and then his voice whispered softly in my ear.
"He suffers from a mutual phobia, for he was as much afraid of Miss Wintrow as she was of him. They are connected, and now share each other's fear, unable to escape. Can you not see the connection?"
For a moment I could not imagine what Phelps was talking about, but then he reached out into the air above the cradle and took hold of something, carefully winding it around his fingers and pulling a section tight. All at once I saw it, a tangible mass of smoky black cord twisting through the air. One end was attached in a mad tangle to whatever lay in the cradle, while the other snaked through the air and disappeared out the door. Where Phelps had grasped it, he pulled about 5 inches tight in a thin line, and I could see the shadow seeping into his hands like spilled ink. "What do we do?" I asked in a fearful whisper.
"Break the connection," he replied.
"How?"
"The best way you see fit."
I hesitated one moment, then did the only thing I could think of. Brought my hand down in a quick, cutting motion where Phelps held the string tight. As my skin touched it, I felt it burn intensely for a second, then break apart with a snap that was felt more than heard. With a hissing sound like a wet fire, the smoky cord vanished, and the darkness around the cradle began to lift. I had to stifle a scream as I felt the sudden sensation of many soft bodies running over my feet and around my legs, for all of Clarence's children came swarming over the floor and up the side of the cradle, making delighted squeaking noises as they went. Clarence himself stood speechless in the doorway, outlined against the light in a stark black silhouette. Coming to sit beside him, Una made an approving sound and thumped her tail twice on the floor. We did not leave the way we had come. After many expressions of sincere gratitude from Clarent and all his children, and after Piora had spent 30 minutes hunting about in her room to procure a curious brooch with a shadowy stone in it to present to us, we were led out the other end of the main room and through a dark maze of pillared corridors. Stopping at one of the many doors between the pillars, Clarent pushed it open and indicated with his tail the way to go. After a final exchange of thanks and good wishes, we parted company, and I followed Phelps as he led the way down the narrow passage, pausing to turn back and wave several times. The passage stretched only 50 yards or so before ending in a small octagonal room with a single flickering lamppost. Beyond this was another ladder,
this time made of wood, which led up through a hole in the ceiling. With a growing sense of resignation, I followed in Phelps's footsteps up the ladder. However, this time the climb was not nearly as long, and in moments I heard the scrape of stone as Phelps thrust aside the trap door at the top, and we emerged into the pale grey light of an early dawn.
"I say!" I exclaimed in surprise, for we had come out right in the middle of the quadrangle, where there was a stone-flagged square around the fountain with the statue of Arisia Tor.
Phelps merely chuckled and helped Una out onto the ground and carefully replaced the stone. Like that, you would never know a trap door even existed.
"A successful night, Corianne. A very successful night," Phelps said happily, rubbing his hands together. "Now come, let us see if it has had as fortunate effect on your young friend."
The night did have a very fortunate effect on Alice Wintrow. When we arrived, she was sleeping soundly and peacefully, and she awoke in the late morning with only the foggiest memories of her nightmares and delirium. The nurses, confused though they were, decided it must have been brought on by stress caused by schoolwork, and prescribed Alice some leave time, which she gratefully accepted. Phelps stayed on for a few days more, ostensibly because he had developed a keen interest in the local bird life, but really so that he could seal off all the entrances to Clarence's underground home, for as he explained to me, hallmanders were completely harmless as long as they had limited contact with humans. Upon being asked why Una got along with us so well then, he merely smiled and tapped his nose.
"That's why she's Una, dear Corianne."
Another thing Phelps did during his extended stay was corner Hilda and Geist, as well as some of the other older girls, and give them a thorough lecture. I was not present for this, so I do not know exactly what he told them, but it had a wonderfully sobering effect. Then suddenly it was time for him to leave, and the world began to seem much more mundane and boring. While I thought the monotony of classes and homework and petty school feuds would be a welcome relief from the haunting adventures I had with Phelps, the truth was, our escapade in the basement with the snakes and ladders had reawakened in me a thirst for excitement. Sitting in the common room with 2 days' worth of homework stacked up beside me, I felt the boredom descending upon me like a stifling blanket. But before he left, Phelps took me aside just as the morning classes started. He was dressed resplendently in deep purple velvet and silk, being on his way to investigate a missing gemstone belonging to a famed enchanter.
"A dull, featureless task," he assured me, waving his hand dissuasively.
Featureless indeed, but more interesting than what I had in store that day.
"Corianne," Phelps said, taking me gently by the elbow. I looked up to find his face so full of genuine concern that I looked right back down again.
"Are you absolutely certain you will be all right here?"
"I will be fine," I said, not wanting to meet his gaze. "Life will be a little dull for a while. I shall just be bored."
Phelps let go my elbow, stretching up to his full, impressive height, and raised an eyebrow.
"Bored?"
"Yes."
Wind blew through the quadrangle, bending the grass sideways and whistling past the statue of Arisia Tor.
"Corianne, are you happy here?"
I fiddled with my book bag, not wanting to answer. My emotions were so jumbled up it was difficult to describe them. I wonder what a hallmander would have made of me at the moment, all torn and confused on the inside. It wasn't only that I was grappling with the disillusionment of my schooling, but that I also had reservations of what the alternative held.
"No,"
I said at length, mumbling a little.
"Do you want to stay?"
Lots of people got good educations, I thought. Lots of people live productive, respectable, boring lives. Not many, I fancied, got to live with a world-renowned magician.
"No," I said, clearer this time.
when do you want to come home? This required some consideration.
2 weeks, I think, I said at length. I will give notice this morning, and that will be easier for everyone. I don't mind waiting.
Phelps scoffed. Corianne, I could have you out of here tomorrow by batting an eye, he said. But I could tell he was really pleased. Setting his top hat on his head, he saluted me with his cane, spun on his heel, and marched out of the school grounds. I turned the other way, towards the dull brick and dark-windowed buildings and morning class. Yet the monotony seemed bearable now, lit with the warm assurance of better times and new adventures waiting around the corner. The end.
I think it's worth mentioning that I didn't go to school. I think this is worthwhile because, unless I tell people, they often don't realize that I didn't. I think this fact simply proves my point that you don't need loads of schooling to get on in life. It's just so many people assume that you do that they don't give their children the opportunity to try things differently. But it's a frightening thing, letting a child loose and seeing what it does. Look at my mother. She let me do whatever I liked, and I grew up to be a writer. But I must say, if you have ever taken enjoyment of my work, be it my stories, my readings, or my artwork, you have my mother to thank for that. Because if she hadn't undertaken the Herculean task of extracting me from the public school system, I probably would never have become the person I am today. If I achieve anything worthwhile in my life, it is not in spite of not going to school. It is because I didn't. So it is understandable that I saw Corianne's entrance into a school as the death of any possibility for further adventures, and Phelps and I agreed that we should get her out of there as soon as possible. In this, as you have just heard, we were entirely successful. And because there are people who will insist school is actually quite worthwhile, keep this in mind, that I do not challenge so much the usefulness of schools, but the assumption that they are the only way to educate people. That ranting aside, for anyone interested in reading more about Bo Ragnar Phelps, you can find this and all his adventures available as ebooks the world over in the Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, and the iTunes iBook stores. You can also find the complete catalog of my work over on my own website, goldeneogawa.com/books. Some people have asked if they may donate money to support the podcast, and to tell the truth, I hadn't planned on setting up a donation button thing. So for now, just go buy some ebooks. Think of it as donating money to the podcast and getting an ebook as a thank you. Whether or not you can donate / buy an ebook, thank you for listening, and I hope you tune in next week when I'll be reading the 5th adventure of Bo Ragnar Phelps, The Last Dragon. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or feedback about the podcast, or you just want to talk to me, you can email me at goldeneogawa, that's GOLDENOGAWA, @gmail.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at GrimbyTweets. And that's not all! Now I am on Goodreads. Search for Goldene Ogawa, or you can go directly to goodreads.com/GrimbyReads. And as always, you can check out the description attached to this podcast for all those good links nicely typed out for your copying plus pasting needs. That's all for this week's episode, but before I let you go, I just have to say special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldene, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldene for creating the theme music, and of course to you, for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeenogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun. Thank you.